because now during break, everyone's going to be going, chicken nuggets. They're going to all run across the street. And what? Or yogurt with chopsticks, but somehow the nuggets are going to win. That's my bet. I'm placing bets for the nuggets. Then many people are going to come back after break with chicken nuggets. Here's what we did last time. We talked about refrigerators. We ran the Carnot cycle. We saw that we could run the Carnot cycle forward and get it to be a heat engine and get work out of it. So that if we ran it backwards, it turned into a refrigerator to pump heat from a cold spot into a warmer spot. And we talked about, again, there's a Carnot measure of a refrigerator, which was the coefficient of performance. It was not constrained to be less than or greater than 1. It could be anything. But the Carnot limit was not something that any real machine could beat. So any real refrigerator is constrained by the Carnot limit on the refrigerator, which was set by the high temperature reservoir and the low temperature reservoir. And we talked about the path dependence of heat and work. That is, heat and work are processes. So they depend on the path taken. And they're not state variables, which are characteristics of the system. So I can't look at the table here and say, this table has a certain amount of heat in it. That's not a meaningful statement. If I burned the table, it would produce a certain amount of heat. That's a meaningful statement. So processes give you heat or work. And another example of the path dependence of these things was if I, moved a heavy object 1 foot up to a higher shelf, there's a certain amount of work involved. But if I took the heavy object and moved it around and carried it with me to Washington, D.C. before bringing it back and putting it 1 foot higher, I would do a lot more work. So the work depends on, work and heat both depend on the path, what you do to the thing. We talked about irreversible work and how that can be converted to heat. So when you do work in an irreversible manner, basically it went into heat. Okay. We talked about the relation of the free energy to work. So even though I can't look at the table and say, this table has 10 joules of work in it, 10 joules of heat in it, I can't do that. I could look at it and tell you what its free energy is. Okay, and I could say, oh, it's got 20 joules of free energy, which means that it could be converted into use that amount of useful work. Okay, so that's the kind of the way around that. And the free energy, the Helmholtz free energy, is designed to tell you how much work you can get out of a substance when you are controlling the variables of the Helmholtz free energy, okay, which is volume, temperature, and number. If you have a different situation, you'll use a different free energy, and that free energy will tell you how much energy you can extract from the system. We also related the chemical potential to chemical work, so that since there's, if I set up two systems that have a chemical potential difference between them, and I want to import particles from the lower chemical potential to the higher chemical potential, I have to input work to do that. And that's the equivalent of chemical work. Okay, and we also discussed then, since that's a form of work, we discussed the connection between chemical work and mechanical work. You can generally convert various types of work into other types of work. So in the case of the ideal gas, the chemical potential goes up when you compress the ideal gas. And then if I let go of it, its chemical potential then could do, could be converted into chemical work to get it to expand again. So there's a connection there between those things. We also talked about superconductivity. I should have written this down. Superconductivity and how superconductors expel magnetic fields. We had the example on screen of Tosunumi, the sumo wrestler, being levitated because he was standing on a magnet, and the magnet was levitating over a superconductor. So I have, you might have noticed, funny objects up here. We'll get to those just before the break. So I have the demo here of superconductors with levitating magnets. So we'll set that up before break. And you can play around with it. Question?
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that the free energy tells you how much work you can get out of the system as an upper limit.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So it doesn't necessitate that you'll get 20.
That's right. It's an upper limit. Because I could take the system and do something irreversible to it, and then, might not get as much useful stuff out of it. Yeah, good point. Any other questions? Yeah.
I'm just curious, on the refrigerator aspect,
yeah.
Do our refrigerators really have the high and low temperature reservoirs?
Yes, it's the inside of the inside of your refrigerator is colder than the ambient room temperature.
Okay, so there's not actually like a pocket of liquid, some gas or something like that sitting in the middle of our refrigerator.
There is. If you look on the back of the refrigerator, there'll be coils. And the coils have, some sort of coolant like Freon. I don't know if they use Freon anymore. That was determined to be a greenhouse gas. So they have updated ones that have some terrible name like RC894. And anyway, pardon? Yeah, exactly. My air conditioner in my car had to be converted over because it was leaking, and they said, you have to use the new one. So there, if you look on the back of the refrigerator, there'll be coils, and there's an actual coolant back there that's being run through various cycles.
Okay.
Yeah, and then the two reservoirs are the inside of the refrigerator and the outside of the refrigerator. Yeah. So how would you use a refrigerator to cool your apartment if you needed to do it?
Put a hole in your wall and put the back
into
it. Exactly. You have to have the high temperature reservoir not be in your apartment. You can't cool your apartment just by opening the refrigerator door. As Kyle points out, you need to do a little bit of property damage first. You need to cut a hole in the wall and make the exhaust feed to somewhere other than your apartment. In your door, for example, the less property damage, yeah, way to do it. Oh, I see. You don't want to open the door to the fridge. You just want to crawl inside. That has other environmental issues, of course. My little brother did that experiment, by the way, when he was, you know, a kid with our cat. We had an empty refrigerator, and you know, it's a good thing my mom walked by in time to hear the cat on the inside.
Actually, my brother did that too.
Really? It's something about little brothers and cats in refrigerators. Yeah. The cat survived. No cats were harmed in the telling of that story. So today we have not a huge list here, but we'll talk about what happens in chemical reactions. What is the right free energy to describe chemical reactions? And that will turn out to be the Gibbs free energy. And chemists like the Gibbs free energy because it has the right control variables for chemists. Okay? And from that, we will derive what's called the law of mass action, which ends up telling you what's the relative equilibrium concentrations if you have a chemical reaction in equilibrium. And I'm hoping this is still working, that your notes now, the little blanks, are synchronized with the little blanks up here so that you'll know to fill them in, okay? So the Gibbs free energy, what is the Gibbs free energy? We're going to take the Helmholtz free energy and simply add PV, okay? So we start off with the thermodynamic identity. dU is tau d sigma minus pdV plus mu dN, which you have committed to memory and haunts you every night in your dreams, I hope. Okay, this is heat in minus work out plus particles in. But in the Gibbs system, what we'd like to do is change those out. Okay, we do Legendre transforms to switch which variable in the thermodynamic pair we care about. Right. So here, for example, we're going to convert into n tau and p as the variables of the system, whereas the internal energy was originally defined in terms of all the extensive variables, the entropy, volume, and number. Okay, so we'll have to trade sigma for tau and volume for pressure to get down to the Gibbs free energy. So we do that by the usual Legendre transform. We'll take the internal energy and subtract off tau sigma and add PV. Okay, that'll switch both of those pairs of thermodynamically conjugate variables. So altogether, the derivative of the Gibbs free energy is dU minus now tau d sigma minus sigma d tau plus pdv plus vdp. We just took the derivative of the two terms that we added to the internal energy, right? You're used to this, right? You can do these manipulations with half your brain tied behind your head, I hope. Okay, all right. And at the end of the day, then, dg is minus sigma d tau plus vdp plus mu dN, and you can read off by the differentials what the control variables are for the Gibbs free energy. So the control variables are tau, pressure, and N, which is nice because that's what chemists like. Chemists like to control. You know, they do reactions in a controlled and closed environment, so N is held constant, but they can also pretty easily control the temperature and the pressure of something. Are there any questions about that? Okay, we'll just study the Gibbs free energy for a while. So the Gibbs free energy, again, here's its differential. Okay, so here's how you would set something up where the Gibbs free energy was the right free energy to be studying. Here I have a system capped off by a plunger, okay, and the plunger is in contact with what we're calling the pressure reservoir, okay, So if you're a chemist in a chemistry lab, there's really tubes running off of this with little pressure gauges to make sure that you maintain the correct pressure up there. And then the plunger, of course, is free to slide frictionlessly, and that'll maintain the same pressure in the system. The system is also immersed in a temperature reservoir, okay? So heat can be exchanged through this barrier so that the system has the same temperature as the temperature reservoir. So, you know, for example, this could be a bath of ice water if you're trying to keep it at 32 degrees Fahrenheit, or, you know, it could be some other large temperature reservoir that you could maintain the temperature of. And in this kind of condition, you're setting the pressure, you're setting the temperature, and it's a closed system, so you're setting N. So the Gibbs free energy is the right thing to use, and when you let the system go and do whatever it's going to do, it will change and evolve until its Gibbs free energy is minimized. Question?
What does the plunger do?
The plunger is just a frictionless little piston on top of it, okay, that's closed. It won't allow heat or particles to pass through, but it does slide, and all that will do is just equilibrate the pressure between the two. Any other questions? Okay. There's what's inside the box. So when you're controlling temperature, pressure, and N, that means that d tau is 0, dp is 0, dn is 0. So you read this off and you say, gosh, everything's 0, so dg is 0. Okay. And how do we know that it's minimal? You know, so this tells you that the Gibbs free energy will be at an extremum. It doesn't tell you whether it's a maximum or a minimum. But we do know that it must be minimized because any irreversible change, okay, inside the system will increase the entropy, which will drag the Gibbs free energy down by this term, right? Because temperature is positive. So now if your entropy increases, you're going to drag the Gibbs free energy down. Okay, so this means that the Gibbs free energy is the correct free energy that is minimized under those sort of circumstances. And you can develop these differentials of the Gibbs free energy just like we have for all the other energy functions we looked at so far. So we have dg as minus sigma d tau plus vdp plus mu dn. So the entropy, for example, if I want to define what the entropy is in terms of a derivative of the Gibbs free energy, you know how this goes. We say, well, let's set the pressure constant and the number of particles constant. Those are 0. Okay, now I have dg as minus sigma d tau. So sigma, the entropy, is minus dg by d tau at constant p and n. And you can get similar relations for the volume and for the chemical potential. Okay. And now what would you do to get the Maxwell relation or a Maxwell relation? Take the second derivative. That's right. Yeah, question?
Just back on the last page.
Yeah.
You had Gibbs free energy. And you said that it had to be negative because the entropy goes up, so it brings it down. But the volume is changing as well. How do we know that this volume change isn't large enough to compensate for the negative entropy? Because in order to maintain the constant pressure, the plunger is changing the size of the system and the volume.
Okay, I see what you're saying. That there could be several things changing at once, so it's not terribly obvious what will happen. I'm thinking. Yeah. Okay. So let's go back to the differential here. Okay. So temperature. Let's see. Yeah, I'm not sure what to do with the possible changes in the volume, because we're not necessarily going to allow the pressure to change. We've got that taken care of. And an irreversible change would certainly increase the entropy. So that certainly drags this thing down. And if it's if it's reversible, then you know, everything should simply have been in equilibrium in the first place. So I guess all you really need to worry about here is what kind of irreversible changes could mess this guy up. So I guess we need to ask the question, is there an irreversible process that would change the volume suddenly? I'm not sure about that. Does anybody see the answer?
You like something blowing up?
Like an explosion inside?
That would change the volume significantly.
Yeah, it would. Yeah.
Or like just opening up a little.
Yeah, just kind of, you know, maybe just jostling the system really fast would cause something.
I don't understand what the problem of the question is.
So I think the question is that I said here, we know that the Gibbs free energy is minimized. It's certainly an extreme, because we know that under these conditions, then the Gibbs free energy, the change in it will be zero, as long as that's going on. So was it, you know, the processes that led to that, was that leading to a minimum, or was that leading to a maximum, is the question. And so I argued that if you have an irreversible change, the entropy certainly increases, so this term will drag it down. But I didn't give you a proof that that term is not also going to change in a way that messes it up. So, anyway, I'll think about that. Okay. Okay, so here we have our first derivatives. You told me that to get the Maxwell relations, you would take second derivatives of these things. And since you had this on the midterm, so you know how this goes, you have three control variables. You can derive three different Maxwell relations from that, okay? Because in each case, you'll be holding, when you take the second derivative, there'll be two variables that you've chosen for the second derivative, and 3 choose 2 gives you three possibilities. So the Gibbs free energy, it turns out, is actually directly equal to the number of particles times their chemical potential. So let me show you why that's the case. The thing is that all of these energy functions need to be extensive, okay? Because the total energy in something is an extensive variable. If I copy the system exactly and put it next to itself, I will double whatever energy I'm talking about, whether it's the internal energy, the free energy, the Gibbs free energy. And we've already determined that the Gibbs free energy's variables are n, tau, and p, but only n is extensive, okay? So if I write some formula down for the Gibbs free energy, it has to be proportional to n, okay? So the Gibbs free energy, being a function of n, tau, and p, is n times some function, okay? So we know what the n dependence goes like. That's the only extensive variable I have. And then everything else I can subsume into, well, it's some sort of function of temperature and pressure, but that's not going to change the extensive property. Okay, so I pulled off the one extensive variable I know about. Turns out that this, whatever this leftover function is, has to be the chemical potential. So the Gibbs free energy is nice in that way. It's n times the chemical potential. Or what we'll see is if you have several particles, you'll have a sum here of number of that type of particle times its chemical potential plus number of other particle times its chemical potential, and so on. So let's see why this is the case. So we'll show this for the ideal gas. And so again, sorry, there's a question? All right. So the Gibbs free energy, dG, is minus sigma d tau plus vdp plus mu dn. And in the ideal gas, we can show that the Gibbs free energy must be proportional to n. So you have to remember these equations, though, that for the ideal gas, we had that mu is tau log of, usually we said, concentration divided by quantum concentration, but you could rewrite that as tau log of pressure over tau and Q. So there's a function of pressure and temperature. And the free energy was n tau log of n over V in Q minus 1. So just to remind you where we got these things, in the classical limit of the ideal gas, this is from a previous lecture, so I'll run through this kind of quickly, but to find the chemical potential, we required that the average number of particles in the system equal the actual number of particles in the system, a very reasonable constraint, okay? And so when you took this sum then over the occupancies of each state, right? So here I'm just counting up, look for every state, there's a particular energy associated with that state, there's a particular occupancy, F of E, of that state, and then I sum that up, and that gives me the total number of particles. And in the classical limit, this occupation was always the same. Okay, the occupation was lambda e to the minus epsilon over tau, where epsilon is the energy. And this bit here, right, sum over s e to the minus es over tau, is a partition function. So there it is, partition function. So we know then that this absolute activity lambda is e to the mu over tau. We can work backwards and say, well, there's a mu, okay, this n over z1 was actually equal to n over nqv, because Z1 was NQV, we calculated that before. So once we have then that the concentration divided by the quantum concentration is e to the mu over tau, solve that, and the chemical potential of the ideal gas is temperature times log of the density divided by the quantum density. Okay, so we just got that directly out of requiring that the average number of particles is equal to the actual number of particles. Right, and here was our, I'm not going to go through all this, but just to remind you where it came from, here was our long calculation of how it was that the partition function really was V times NQ or NQ over N. Okay. Just came from assuming that we had free particles that where we were only going to include their kinetic energy. And then we quantize those particles in a box, and there you have it. There's the partition function there. And then the free energy, we could get, okay, now that we have the chemical potential is also dF by dN. So by integrating that with respect to N, then we got the free energy. Okay, so here we're developing the free energy, and the answer is hopefully on the next slide. Okay, there's the free energy. So you can build up the free energy as an integral of the chemical potential over dN. And we come up with that the free energy of the ideal gas is n tau log of n over nq minus 1. We're going through that fast because you've already seen it. Okay, just reminding you where we got these ideal gas relations. So at the top of this slide, I've reminded you of what we know from the ideal gas. Chemical potential is tau log of P over tau NQ. Okay, this is a slightly different form, right? We're used to tau log of N over, well, usually we put the density there, which is N over V, and then divided by NQ, but I substituted in that PV equals N tau. So there we have the function of just pressure and temperature. Here's the free energy. And now the Gibbs free energy is the Helmholtz free energy plus pressure times volume. Pressure times volume in the ideal gas is n tau, okay? So if we put all that together, we get that the Gibbs free energy itself is n tau log of concentration divided by quantum concentration, which is what we set out to prove, right? Okay, there's an n, and then the rest of this thing is the chemical potential. Okay, and the chemical potential really is this function of pressure and temperature that as was promised. Okay, so the ideal gas, it all works out. The Gibbs free energy, which you set up as Helmholtz free energy plus PV, really is N times the chemical potential. Are there any questions about how that came about? Okay, we just put some ideal gas relations together. Okay. You keep it up with the stuff you have to copy. I know you have to take notes furiously in this class. Okay. Here we go. So we could have gotten this another way, okay, without being so specific. And so we just proved it for the ideal gas case, but really this is general, that the Gibbs free energy is mu n. So let me show you a more general way to see that. So we know, okay, we already know that the Gibbs free energy, since it's a function of n tau and p, has to be something I can rewrite as n times this phi, some function of tau and p, which is to be determined. And based on this formula here, okay, which we just argued based on the fact that the Gibbs free energy is extensive. Since it's extensive, it has to be proportional to n. Then dg by dn is phi. Okay? But we also know that, okay, from how we manipulate thermodynamic differentials, right, that dg is minus sigma d tau plus vdp plus mu dn, which means that mu itself is also dg by dn. Okay? And so since dg by dn is dg by dn, that means that this thing here had to have been the chemical potential. Okay, so whether you're using an ideal gas or not using an ideal gas, this is correct. Gibbs free energy is mu times n. And if you add more species, so if you have oxygen and nitrogen in your system, you'll simply add here another term. Okay, you'll say chemical potential of oxygen times its number of particles plus chemical potential for nitrogen times its number of particles. Are there any questions so far? Okay. Gibbs free energy is mu times n. So this is useful for chemists, and it's useful for chemical reactions that are controlled under constant temperature and pressure. So here I've written out the more general form of the differential of the Gibbs free energy. Okay, we were saying that dG was minus sigma d tau plus vdP plus mu dN, but here I've put a sum over various labels for different species. Okay, so the little sum over j mu sub j dN sub j just means add up over the different species that are in your chemical reaction that you're watching. So one chemical reaction, for example, would be the breakup of hydrochloric acid into hydrogen and chlorine. Okay. This is why you shouldn't go sniffing bottles of hydrochloric acid. Don't do that. Okay? Because there's chlorine gas in equilibrium with it, and chlorine gas is very corrosive to your lungs and your general respiratory system. So never do that. Never sniff bottles of hydrochloric acid. Okay. I have a pool, so I take care of my pool and always have little chlorine tablets and things like that. And one of the ways you can balance out your pool chemistry is also by adding hydrochloric acid. So I always try to remind myself, don't breathe when you open these chemicals. Gases come off. Pardon?
Acid pool?
Well, I added a, you know. It was all balanced by the time you guys come. But actually, you want to keep the, so the way pool chemistry goes. Oh my gosh, it's really complicated. But one of the things you want to keep correct is the pH so that you don't erode people's skin, for one thing. If it's too basic, you'll hurt humans. And if it's too acidic, you'll eat your pipes and the pump. So you have to keep it just balanced right to where it's this middle pH that's not going to corrode pipes and not going to eat up people's feet. So you add acid to bring it one way and you add base to bring it the other way in.
Couldn't acid eat people's skin too?
What?
Couldn't acid eat skin too?
Well, not quite as bad as basic things do. Yeah. We stay away from all sorts of extreme pHs, but bases are far worse for you than acids. For, you know, organic things. And okay, so back to our chemical reaction here. Hydrochloric acid, okay, so if I had hydrochloric acid, there would be some concentration as well of just a plain old hydrogen gas with chlorine gas, okay? And, you know, you just count the atoms here to see how that goes. Two HCl molecules can break up into one H2 plus a Cl2, okay? So I have three species in here in this chemical reaction. And, you know, depending on the temperature, there'll be different relative concentrations that come up in equilibrium for these things, okay? So because this corresponds to, you know, I have to dissociate the HCl molecule, and then I have to make new H2 and Cl2 molecules. And so it'll be in chemical equilibrium, though, okay? So if this reaction is happening, it's in chemical equilibrium. So the Gibbs free energy can't be changing, yet I have all these sums over mu dN's, okay, to make that true, okay? So the change in hydrochloric acid, for example, let's just go one step in the reaction. Let's say that what's happening is that it's heading to the right, okay? HCl, two HCls are getting together producing hydrogen and chlorine gases. So for one step in that reaction, the change in the number of HCls was minus 2, so I took away two of them. And then I gained one H2 and I gained one Cl2. So the right way to balance the Gibbs free energy in that case is to sum up chemical potentials times these changes in species numbers. Okay? So I just write it all out. You know, it starts looking like a mess, but you just kind of have to go through it slowly here and see what it is. So chemical potential of HCl times change in number of HCl molecules plus chemical potential of hydrogen molecule times change in number of hydrogen molecules plus chemical potential of the Cl2 molecule times its change in number. All of those summed together has to equal zero as the reaction progresses one way or the other. And this is, so another way to say this is chemical potential times minus 2, okay, plus mu H2 times 1 plus mu Cl times 1 is 0. Now you can read all of that off the chemical reaction, right? So this was the chemical reaction equation. If I put the 2 HCl on the right-hand side, right, then I would have a minus 2 HCl over there. And so then I could just read off that number. Minus 2 goes here, 1 goes here, and 1 goes there. I'm just reading off the coefficients of the chemical reaction equation and putting the right chemical potentials in front. So really, when you see this chemical reaction equation, it's just a shorthand, okay? What it means is that as this reaction progresses, this is really what's happening. Okay, so one step in this chemical reaction process will, cause this change in the Gibbs free energy plus this change plus that change, which will balance out. Is there any questions so far? Okay. So here's what we had from the previous slide. And again, I could rearrange that, right, to have the minus 2HCl on the same side as the 1 times hydrogen, 1 times H2 plus 1 times Cl2. Sum of those together is 0. And then to make that Gibbs free energy statement, okay, that the change in the Gibbs free energy was 0, I just copy down the coefficients of the reaction. Here's a minus 2 goes there in front of mu HCl. Here's a plus 1, so the plus 1 goes in front of mu H2. Here's a plus 1 in front of mu Cl2. You just transcribe, okay? So this reaction was just shorthand for this Gibbs free energy statement. And now we could throw more notation at it. I'm using notation out of your book, okay? So here's the notation your book throws at it, out of it. Well, okay, so a general chemical reaction, which I write as the sum over coefficients of the chemical reaction nu times chemical species A, okay, the sum over that is 0, really means that the sum over species of the coefficients of the reactions times their respective chemical potentials, that sum is 0. Okay, so we just translate it directly up here, but here's the notation your book would use for that. Okay. Now, I think I'm going to take 10 minutes now and set up the superconductivity stuff before we get into the next thing here is we're going to start setting up the law of mass action. Okay, so we'll put that off till after break, set up the law of mass action after break. But let me remind you what we were talking about last lecture with superconductivity. Somewhere down here is Tosanumi. There he is. Okay. Tosanumi, the sumo wrestler, levitating. Right. We talked about how superconductors have to do work to do that. Right. So superconductors. Excuse me. Okay. So most metals become superconductors if you take them to low enough temperature. I have here some shards of some of the new high-temperature superconductors. Oops, so try not to break them any further, because if you drop them, they will crack more. But you can see, just pass those around, and you'll be able to see that they're not metallic, okay? And this, here's a complete wafer of it. So you're holding, and it's black, it's not shiny, okay? Like, metals, right, most metals will become superconductors if you get them to low enough temperatures. This thing is a hunk of material that was discovered in 1986, YBCO, yttrium barium copper oxide. It's what you're passing around. Looks nothing like a metal. You can tell it's not a metal. You hold it, and it doesn't feel cold like a metal. It's not shiny. It's black. It's ceramic. Turns out if you drop it, it'll crack, okay, because it's of the ceramic family, just like your plates. And when it's not superconducting, it's actually a really good insulator. So this is a material that really, by all rights, has no business conducting at all. But if you, here comes liquid nitrogen. If you get it cold enough, though, it will become a perfect conductor. So I'm going to just let these guys get cool. Okay, so I'm just pouring liquid nitrogen over to get it cold. YBCO superconductors work around 100 Kelvin or less. So liquid nitrogen being at 77 Kelvin is cold enough. So once those work their magic and get the superconductors cool off, then they'll be in the superconducting phase. And, okay, I have here plastic tweezers for picking up magnets. We have some nice magnets in here. Actually, whoa, there you go. You can show that those guys were magnets because they snap together. And if you have two of those pieces of the superconductor, you can prove to yourself that those are not magnets, because when you put one superconducting piece next to another superconducting piece, they do not attract. Does anybody have two of those? Max is trying to give you one. Oh, you have two of them. Show us, show us. You're showing that they don't do this. Whoops.
Oh, you're right. They're not magnets.
They're not magnets. I'm trying to get them to snap onto each other. Yeah, like that. Okay. So anyway, his are not magnetic. These guys are the magnets. Okay. So these are rare earth magnets. Okay. So now here's where the fun starts.
Did you say rare earth?
Rare earth.
What does that mean?
There's a line in your periodic table called the rare earths. It starts with lanthanum or something. Some of the big elements down at the bottom. They make nice, lanthanides or rare earths. There we go. This guy's levitating. Let me get this other one started. And then you can come up and play with it. Oh, there we go. Okay, these guys are working. They're levitating. Come on up and give it a try. You want to use the plastic tweezers. That one's just going like crazy.
I don't know if it's levitating.
Push it down.
Well, you have to play with it.
Oh, good job.
I dropped it in liquid nitrogen. Can I play it? Can these go in liquid nitrogen?
That isn't really levitating.
Yeah, just don't throw them on the ground afterwards.
Oh, that was lame. There. Yeah, that's levitating.
I'm not going to touch it anymore.
So, the rare earth magnets are really neat because when magnets form the electrons inside, you need to have little magnets associated with them. Then all the little magnets line up. So one way they can do that is by the electron spins. So if all the electron spins in a material line up, you get a huge big magnet. Okay. And with the rare earths, not only is it the electron spin lining up, but if you have, say, F orbitals in a very large atom, okay, the F orbitals, you know what I'm talking about, S, P, D, F, and so on, right? So they go up to the higher orbitals on an atom, they can get more complicated angular momentum. And then the angular momentum can assist the spin, right? And so if I have an atom with net angular momentum, it means the electrons are doing a little loop around it, right? And a little loop like that is a little current loop, is a little electromagnet, little nano-electromagnet, actually. So in these rare earth magnets, what's happening is that the atoms have a very high orbital angular momentum associated with them. All the little current loops line up and they make a nice strong magnet.
That's awesome.
Neat.
And superconductors don't like magnetic fields. So
is this liquid boiling? That's why you see the boiling?
Yeah.
What's that?
This is the same superconducting stuff. And if we had the equipment here, we could test its resistivity while we did this. So what I'm giving you is sort of the easy demonstration that you have superconductivity because superconductors expel magnetic fields. So one of the things they'll do when they start superconducting is they will...
She wasn't chilled.
They'll do anything possible to keep magnetic fields out of themselves. So what the superconductor's doing is as it felt the magnetic field get close to it, it generated its own spontaneous screening currents. It's actually beyond Lenz's law. It's like Lenz's law, except that Lenz's law would actually... die out after a while, because Lenz's law is only about changes in magnetic field. This is very much like Lenz's law. It's one step beyond it. It's what we call perfect diamagnetism, where it doesn't just notice the change in magnetic field, but it also doesn't even like a net magnetic field. So it's beyond. I'm glad you brought that up because it's beyond Lenz's law.
What if we put the magnet on before it's magnetic?
So you can actually kind of force the magnet right down on it too. Right.
That doesn't make any sense.
What, the fact that I can do that?
Yeah.
It's just not a strong enough magnet to be. You know, I just overcame the forces, that's all. Because I'm so strong.
Oh, I see.
Julia's surprised.
No, because I don't have the ingredients to make.
We could go to the gas station and get some.
So, like, how would you make this superconductor? Because this is fun.
Oh, actually, okay. So you can either buy the kit from Edmund Scientific for about $30.
You can
buy all those eyes just lit up. Wow, you can buy this kit.
Yeah. I thought you could say like $300.
No, $30 or $40 for the kit.
Do you need like a kiln?
I think they give you one or two. No. When I say kit from Edmund Scientific, I mean they made it for you. This kit is from Edmund Scientific.
Oh.
Oh, you
want to
make it?
Make it.
Okay, you can make it.
Yeah, because I want a bigger one.
Set up there. So you can make it, actually. There's a website that gives you the instructions for making it. And that is... Actually, I'll show you what it is. It's at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory website. They give you instructions for how to make YBCO. So you just need the right materials, yttrium, barium, copper, oxygen. You need a...
How hard is it to get your hands on that?
Pretty hard.
Really?
Yeah.
Let's see how long...
But for educational purposes, you might be able to convince someone that you needed to do this, you know. So yttrium, barium, copper, and oxygen. And you mix them together in the right, you need the right crucible. And then you have to cook it at 900 degrees Celsius for a long time.
Yeah, so you need 13 like hours.
So like
you need a kiln and an oxygen
oven.
Source. Right, so your home oven won't do it. You need a kiln. Like a, but a pottery kiln would work, right? Convert a pottery
like
kiln.
Oh,
yeah, where can you order liquid nitrogen from?
Well, see, you know, I don't know where to get your own personal
really
supply of liquid nitrogen.
The most expensive part is the container.
The doer, yeah.
You can get a big container for 30 bucks.
Thanks.
It's pretty hard to get most pure chemicals higher up on the periodic chart.
Yeah.
Is there like something where we can
That's
distill
cool.
it from?
But I bet if you convince the outreach people that you'd like to have chemistry students in high school build YBCO, you could get your hands on this stuff.
Oh my god, if somebody came to my high school and did that, I would like die of happiness. I would go into a joy coma.
And then come back to life, right?
Yeah.
I think we should build a huge super reactor and trust people.
Right.
Yeah, I guess that wouldn't be a good selling point. I'd die.
What's wrong with that? You can't get it to spin?
No.
It's not floating.
It is floating.
It's floating.
It's floating.
There
you go.
Oh, you missed it.
Only you can get it to spin as well.
There's so much resistance.
So what do you think about the fact that it's actually stable in there and not hopping off? I mean, if it was purely, well, when you push it, it hops off. But if it was purely repulsive, it probably wouldn't be stable.
Whenever the magnetic field on that comes in,
pour that out.
Yeah, there is something going on there, actually.
Cool.
You guys need a refill?
Is your pointed off? Is that extremely cold?
The steam is not all that bad.
Okay.
How much
as long as it doesn't freeze your hands,
where can you get liquid nitrogen?
Can we just ask?
It just boils right off.
Yeah. Well, see, I got it from lecture demonstrations because we needed it for official educational purposes.
I love pouring it on tables.
Some
hospitals.
Yeah,
this
is what's really cool is you pour it on a really dirty floor.
Yeah,
and
it
makes it
stop.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I do that down in Thailand. Do it near the kitchen or the... That thing should have.
You're going to get the floor wet.
See all the dust.
I did it. Push all the dust out.
Wait. We have the rest of that to use for class purposes.
So let's go.
Now, how
tell you what, you turn around.
So maybe at the end of class.
Let's find something to freeze and break.
How difficult is it to manufacture liquid nitrogen?
Just don't your hand.
Because maybe something could be selling them back. Because like, maybe you could start a company that sold cleaning supplies made of liquid.
I think there would be huge liabilities associated with that.
Yeah,
so what I was going to tell you about the magnet and why it's stable and why it doesn't just fall off the side, because you can kind of, you see how we kind of wiggled and it's pretty stable, right? It doesn't just fly off. So there's more than just a repulsive force going on there. So mainly the superconductor is creating screening currents and, you know, levitating the magnet. But the superconductor is also not perfect, so it has defects in it. And there are places where a line of magnetic field can come into the superconductor, and then it gets basically trapped in there. So when I put the magnet on top of it, I actually push down a little bit, and that forces a few magnetic field lines to go into defects in the superconductor, and then they're trapped.
Are you dead?
And then it kind of holds it there.
What are you saying about like people have death structures, like organized structures of these little magnetic fields?
Yeah.
I'm dead by shock.
Yeah. Actually, we might be able to pick up one of the superconductors.
I don't know what Kyle's doing.
Like the spinning of the. The spinning of the.
So these are not magnetic here. Can I have the other tweezers real quick? Let's see if we can pick up. Because there's an actual, there's a repulsive force, but there's also a slight attractive force. I just want to see if
is
we
because
can
because it's square.
Demonstrate
if it was
that.
Round, would they fly off?
No, it's because the it's because there are defects in the superconductor, and little magnetic field lines. Oh, because the magnet's cold. I don't want to touch it.
It's not that cool.
Okay.
What are we looking at now?
Well, I'm trying to see if I can get the magnet. If I can demonstrate this fact that the magnet. is both repelled and attracted to the superconductor. No, I don't have enough magnetic strength here to pick it up.
We need a bigger magnet.
Maybe.
Larger hammer.
Maybe. Yeah,
larger
really.
Hammer?
What?
All right.
Oh.
Well, okay, it didn't work. I'm sorry, what?
Where's the top layer so foggy? Right here, there's no liquid, right? But there's a certain amount of fog on top.
Right, so the nitrogen's boiling off. When it boils, it technically turns into vapor, and you can't see vapor. But then the vapor hits the air and condenses again. So you're really seeing little condensed droplets of well, actually, water. Yeah, it's pulling water out of the air.
Really
so.
Cool. That's pretty cool. You can pick it up.
Whoa, whoops. Sorry about that. Trying to separate these guys.
So if you like just when you set the magnet spinning, it continues to spin but eventually it slows and stops. Is that just due to air friction? Like if you had this in a vacuum, would it spin forever?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's actually most of the friction is due to the magnetic field lines that are penetrating the superconductor at the defects.
So
that costs energy to
stop even if it's in a vacuum.
And that's actually
a perfect superconductor.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But even well, it depends on the type of superconductor. These superconductors actually, sorry, trying to separate them. Where'd it go? Here, don't pick it up with your hands.
That's cool. Oh, why not?
Well,
I'm sure it's fine.
Because I don't want you to get hurt.
No,
my old professor would.
So, does metal make better superconductors than ceramics?
No, actually, these guys, they're just weird. They have no right to conduct whatsoever, and they become much better superconductors than the usual metals. They can handle more. Ow, ooh, that even hurt my hands there. They can handle higher currents, and they operate at higher temperatures. They're just superior, except for the fact that they're brittle ceramics, and so it's really hard to make wires out of them. So people have gotten a bit creative, and whoops, at least I separated it. People have gotten a bit creative in trying to make wires out of these guys. They'll, for example, take the ceramic and crush it up. As you can see, that's easy to do. And then they'll put shards of it inside of silver coax or aluminum coax. Something that can bend. So it'll crush the powder inside of standard coax, and then it turns out that the superconducting powder, as long as it's squished in tight enough, is good enough, it'll superconduct and carry nice current.
Would that also the number of defects, because you have a smaller space of superconductors? Or would like the possible gaps between the superconductors, because
they count as defects.
Hey, this one's, ours is bad.
That's because you guys are retarded on that.
Yeah, how do people find these things? Do they just combine every chemical they can find in their lab until something works? Or, I mean, I'm just trying to think how they came across this bizarre.
Yeah, well, okay, so it's a man-made material. So it wasn't a mass occurring material. It was specifically made. And the first one made was lanthanum, strontium, copper, oxygen. And
it's not even more bizarre.
Yeah, it is. And it superconducts at 40 Kelvin, not at 100 Kelvin. But that was enough. 40 was enough. It was shocking enough to where people said, whoa, this is really different. And then based on that material, they started saying, well, let's see if we can show other structures, you know, take that same structure, but substitute out some of the atoms. So basically, by trial and error, they found
But originally, it was accidental, or?
You know, I don't know how
like,
much
wow,
they were expecting it or not.
Okay.
I don't know. But then, from the original material that was discovered in 1986, then they did basically trial and error on that, substituting out various atoms. And it's just because we don't understand yet how these guys work. I work on this, and I think I know how high-temperature superconductors work, but so do other people, and we disagree, right? So
how come, how do the theorists do anything?
No, you're making
well,
that
that's the thing is that
career.
Since we don't understand the material, that's the job of theorists, is why does that guy work? So briefly, what we think is happening is that the electrons inside there line up into little lines, kind of like rockets, okay? And then the little lines have special properties because physics is very different in one dimension from what it is like in two and three dimensions. So waves, for example, are very different in different dimensions. And, you know, so if I throw a stone into a pond and I make a wave on the surface, that two-dimensional wave will just radiate out and go away. But if I threw a stone into a one-dimensional pond, let me just have a long channel of water, right, and I make a wave in it. Where's the wave going to go, right? The wave just keeps going straight down the canal, right? So physics is very different in one dimension from in two and three dimensions, and the line of electrons that we think happens spontaneously at the nanoscale, so, you know, about a nanometer apart, each line is about a nanometer apart, the waves on there basically give you such an odd character that you can get a completely different type of mechanism for superconductivity. And here's a really cool thing about electrons in one dimension. They don't look like electrons anymore. Remember how we did the wave in class? And so we did the wave, and the wave didn't look like a person, even though the crowd was made of people. The one-dimensional system of electrons, you remember that, right? The one-dimensional system of electrons, its basic excitations are collective excitations of the gas, whose waves don't look anything like electrons. They look like spin particles carried separately from charged particles. So in one dimension, if I added a new electron to the system, it really looks like part of the electron spin goes one way and part of the electron goes the other way. Spin goes one way, the charge goes the other way.
What's the scaling issue?
It's really weird. It's like the electron broke up. Uh-huh. It doesn't really. It's just it's a mini body effect.
What's the scaling issue between one dimension?
Oh yeah.
Well, so in this case, the width would be about maybe 4 angstroms and the length would be about 400 angstroms.
Oh, no. Like, are you talking
about so 1 to 100 ratio? Right. Well, what I mean is that the electron motion is confined to one dimension.
Yeah.
So it's still about the Coulomb repulsion. The Coulomb repulsion itself is about photons being able to go in all three dimensions. Okay. So the Coulomb repulsion is the same form, 1/r². But it's just the electrons are confined. Yeah, and it turns out that you can't find excitations in that system that look like an electron. They all look like spins.
Are you going to try to float it over a small piece?
Yeah.
How are they going to confine the electron?
Part of what goes on the material is that it's layered.
What's going to repel?
No, mice.
So there are layers of material automatically.
The tweezers.
So then that confines it into two-dimensional plane. And then the one-dimensional confinement is complicated.
It might be frozen.
No, I can't explain that.
I froze it.
Okay. Okay. But basically there are...
I froze it.
Yeah.
Like a bottle of top.
What are you guys doing?
It's sort of like a spontaneously forming little quantum dots, okay? But they're not quantum dots, they're quantum lines. And it spontaneously forms them.
Look at this.
Would you hold that to the nitrogen?
Do you have a candy bar?
Why do you want to freeze a candy bar? So the material, both of them that you mentioned,
yeah.
And is that something?
Yeah, they all have copper and oxygen in them.
Why?
Do it, try.
No.
But the copper oxygen plane is the important bit.
Put it on the floor.
So we know that. We know the copper oxygen plane is the important bit. And people have made similar materials out of nickel oxygen, where instead of copper, they replaced every copper by nickel.
Oh, that was attractive. I want the little gold nugget by itself.
When copper's in this state where it has a copper oxygen plane and there's other stuff in a copper oxygen plane, each copper has a spin a half extra on it.
Wait, so it's like
copper oxygen, or it's like copper rust. That's right.
There's magnetic fields all around us.
Yeah.
If there was no magnetic
the rare earths in the copper oxygen plane and the rare earth in the copper oxygen plane.
So yeah, so it's almost like the rare earths are rusting and then there's like a rust band in the middle.
Well, actually, the copper is in the form of copper oxygen.
Nice idea, Jordan.
Oh, okay, all right.
You got a quarter.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nice. And when they traded it out for nickel, it doesn't work. It has a lot of similar properties. Looks a lot like it, smells a lot like it, never superconducts as far as we know.
So there's something about copper.
It's all done.
So do you guys want to take a break? We'll restart lecture in about 5 minutes. Is that all right? You need 10 minutes to go get your chicken nuggets.
Okay.
Okay, he's gonna
the lines are pretty long.
Yeah, right. We only have like 4 people.
Four slides.
Yeah, I know. We're pretty close here.
We just finished.
Just finished?
Yeah.
How many people want to just finish? All right. Is anybody missing?
Everyone is done.
Right here. Everybody's here. Okay.
Yay!
Okay, let's just finish lecture.
Is the car still flying if we don't put the magnets on it?
No.
Oh, that was cool.
But there's magnetic fields in the room. Just naturally.
It just warmed up.
Oh,
like from me?
That was kind of cool.
No, well, from here.
Yes,
from
you're very magnetic.
Do I have a magnetic field? Like,
do you have a magnetic personality?
Like this, and it went down to the thing because it warmed up.
Oh, look, it warmed up. Oh.
No, but I saw it warm up. It was cool. And it just went like this.
Yeah, I have a video of that.
Yeah.
Okay, so
that's
fun. We can play with this more after.
After lecture.
So are the other rare earths easier to attain? Is there to make a difference with
I don't know how easy they are to obtain. I haven't ever tried to obtain them.
It doesn't really seem like it's possible to have something darker from temperature.
Well, why? Why not? We didn't think it was possible to have one at 100 Kelvin either. In fact, people thought it capped out around 30 Kelvin.
Because you save energy, right? But like for a superconductor, I don't know. It seems like right now you have to like use energy to superconduct.
Yeah.
So it's a trade-off. But if you had it at room temperature, then you really it's not really costing much. I don't know. It just doesn't seem like it.
So this is my website. I'm just showing you where you can get the where you can get this recipe for making your own high temperature superconductor if you want.
Oh, recipe.
To make it? Oh, there it is. Okay, so there you go, right in the middle.
I mean, it's silly to say that.
Is it made out of things commonly found in our kitchen?
It's not.
That's too bad.
It's not. So there's the website. Copy it on the website. All that stuff right here. Or you can go to my website.
There's some in
the things organic molecules in life.
So if I were to make room temperature superconductors,
have a what?
If I were to make room temperature superconductors,
probably not. Depends. If you're at a university, then the university probably owns most of the technology.
If you go to industry and make money.
So, yeah.
But would you be like,
which would you rather have, though? You know, the satisfaction. That's those Amish values going out. Yeah. All right. Let's finish lecture. So here we are. The chemical potential of the ideal gas was tau log of density over n cubed. Here I put z internal. Remember that? That's the partition function of the internal degrees of freedom. So if you have not just a monatomic ideal gas, but one with internal degrees of freedom, then we need to include this z internal. And all I want to do here is I want to rearrange this a little bit and pull off the density term. Okay, so there's density divided by the other stuff in QZ. Okay, I just want to pull off that other stuff and call it some constant C. Okay, where this constant is independent of the density, but it'll depend on things like the mass and the temperature. Okay, and the internal degrees of freedom. All I've done is rearrange the chemical potential. Okay, so tau log of density minus tau log of this set of constants. So when we have our chemical equilibrium equation, then okay, that the sum over these coefficients in the chemical reaction equation, right? This nu here denotes how many of each species, right, is present in the chemical reaction equation. The sum over that times the chemical potentials is zero, okay? Because those coefficients told you the change in the number of particles at each step, right? And we had remind you what these symbols mean. Here, right, when we had this chemical reaction equation, the minus 2 was one of those nus, okay, or a dN, same thing. The 1 was a dN, the 1 was a dN. Okay. So here, okay, if I write that out, the sum over nu times mu, or this mu is dN, okay, I can write now mu in terms of what we just derived, that the chemical potential is tau, log of n minus log of c. Okay, I'm just trying to pull off the density, okay? Because what I'd like to get is some equation that tells me the relative concentrations of these things in equilibrium. Okay. So now that I've pulled off this constant c, okay, and this term equals zero, now I can say then that this term here equals the other term if I pull it to the other side. So sum over j, nu j, log of nj is sum over j, nu j, log of cj, okay? But now I can put the nu up in the numerator. Sorry, not the numerator, up in the exponent. All right. And then, you remember how this goes, right? I have a sum over logs. But log of A plus log of B is log of A times B. Okay. So I can rewrite this sum over J of these logs of N to the news as log of pi sub J. Have you seen this notation?
Mm-hmm.
The product? Okay. So this is just a, sigma is a sum, pi means product. So take a product sub J, product over all the J's, meaning all the different species in the chemical reaction. Okay. Now I have a log equal to a log, so I can drop the log. Now I know that the product of the chemical concentrations taken to the power of whatever that coefficient was in the chemical reaction, okay, equals the product of these constants to the same power. Okay? So that tells me then what this is about is pull off those constants, and now I'll have an equation that tells me the relative concentrations of all the species in chemical equilibrium. Yes?
The CJs are NJ plus times NJ plus 1 by
N. The CJs are here. NQ, okay, so it's the quantum concentration for that species times its internal partition function. So it was just the thing that I subtracted off of the chemical potential. Chemical potential is tau log of N over NQZ. So here's the NQZ just tied up in that thing. Okay. So this these C's, right? So C to the nu, where nu is the coefficient of the chemical reaction. If I take this product over all the species, what I get out is called the reaction constant. And what's important about it is that it depends on temperature, okay, but not much else that you can change. So remember, the quantum concentration depends on the mass and on H bar. You can't really change those things. It's also got a temperature involved in it. So that's where the temperature dependence is coming from, okay? And we call this K, the reaction constant. And now here, that means that this gives us then the law of mass action, okay? So the product of all the concentrations taken to the power of where this power is the number in the chemical reaction in front, the coefficient, that all equals the reaction constant. And that'll tell me the relative concentrations of things in equilibrium, okay? So it's all a bit technical. So let's just do an example so you know what this stuff means. Here's the law of mass action. Let's look at hydrogen. Okay, molecular hydrogen, H2, also has a certain probability of dissociating into two separate hydrogen atoms. Okay, so since hydrogen likes to form the molecular form, okay, it'll tend to do that at low temperatures. But then, for example, as I raise the temperature on the system, I'll get more dissociation happening because there's some, having the two separated is a higher energy state, but we know according to statistical mechanics, there's some probability that's going to happen once in a while. So what this is going to be able to tell you is what's the relative concentration of the two at a particular temperature. So here's the equation, chemical equation. H2 goes into two H's, okay, so it's just dissociation of molecular hydrogen into atomic hydrogen. I need to put all the reactants on one side so I can count the coefficients properly. So I have H2 minus 2H is 0. Okay, so this gives me the right way to count the coefficients. So the density of hydrogen I'm going to represent by this symbol here. Okay, H with square brackets around that. I believe that's how chemists do it. Okay, denote concentration. And the proper, that's right?
Yeah, I switched them.
Okay, so the coefficient that goes in front of H is 2, there, minus 2, there it is. And the concentration of H2s, okay, we'll represent with that symbol, and its chemical reaction coefficient is 1. Very, very clever to sneak it around like that. Okay, so what does this notation mean? It means take the concentration, raise to the power of whatever the coefficient is in the chemical reaction, and multiply all those together, okay? So H2, okay, its concentration, it had a 1 in front of it, so it's H2 to the 1, okay? The other one is H to the minus 2, right? Okay, so all this means is that the concentration of H2 divided by the concentration of H squared is the reaction coefficient, okay? And that's a function of temperature. So So, you know, which one do you expect to win at very low temperatures? Let's go to really low temperatures. These two, okay? All right. So then you know a little bit about how this function has to look as a function of temperature, okay? So it's going to be mostly H2 at very low temperatures. And then as you raise the temperature, this number is going to have to go down because you'll get more dissociated hydrogen, okay? So the relative concentration depends on temperature. Any questions about that?
So K represents, yeah, a negative exponential.
What now? K represents what?
A negative exponential with respect to temperature.
I don't know the form of it. We might derive that in a few pages.
It's on the next slide.
Okay. All right. So, but we, you know the general form of it, though, that at low temperature, it needs to be such that you're dominated by molecular hydrogen, and then at high temperatures, you'll start getting an equal number of the guys. Okay. So, all right, so you can rearrange this in other ways that you like. All right, if you want to get directly the relative concentration, right, we didn't quite have relative concentration in the previous slide. If you directly want the relative concentration of atomic to molecular hydrogen, you just rearrange our equation a little bit. Okay, so, you know, what have I done here? Not much, but we're trying to rearrange into, right, so basically if I square both sides of this, I'll have the same equation that I had before. Okay, square both sides and then take the H2 to the other side. Okay, so then I get the concentration of H squared, that would be divided by the concentration of H2 is 1 over K. Okay, same thing. Okay, water and pH. Aha, we were just talking about this, the pH of substances. So I can also use this to look at this equilibrium reaction, okay, that water has a certain probability of also dissociating, okay, even though water is a stable molecule. This is a lower energy state than if the water dissociates into H plus an OH minus. But at finite temperature, there's a certain probability that it's going to happen. So there's a certain concentration then of this floating around in water. And at room temperature, though, it's pretty, you know, it's a pretty small concentration of these guys. And so in pure water, you know, what's the pH basically of pure water at room temperature? So this is not going to be all that very excited at room temperature. And the concentrations together, okay, H plus times OH minus is 10 to the minus 14 mole squared per L squared. But the concentration of these guys has to be equal, okay, right? Because every time I break one, I get break a molecule, I get an H plus and I get an OH minus. So these two are equal, right? So I can just take the square root of this guy to get that the concentration of H plus is 10 to the minus 7, okay? And pH is about what's the concentration of bare protons, right? H plus is just a bare proton, okay? It's just a hydrogen atom that's lost its electron, okay? So the definition of pH is minus log base 10. Most of our logs in this class are base E. This is a log base 10. pH is defined as minus log base 10 of the concentration of bare protons in the solution. So then the pH of water is 7. Okay. And basically our pH scales are pretty much then designed relative to water. So if you see a pH that's 7, that's good. I mean, it's about like water. pH of 0 would make it very acidic. Okay. So pH of 3, that... Don't touch pH of 0 thing. That's really bad. pH of 3, though, you're actually pretty used to. Soft drinks are about a pH of 3. Apples are about a pH of 3. Your blood, it turns out, is a little bit more on the basic side. Okay, so organic things tend to be a little bit on this side. And if a substance is basic, okay, it's going to go the other direction on the scale. You get to a higher pH. Okay, there we go. We're on our last slide. Okay. We talked about Gibbs free energy. Here's the differential of it. Its proper variables are temperature, pressure, and number of particles. Chemists like that. Okay, and we saw that basically keeping the Gibbs free energy at a minimum during a chemical reaction leads to this equation, okay? The sum over changes in concentration times the chemical potentials is zero. It also leads to the law of mass action, okay? And we derive the law of mass action, which tells you what's the relative concentration of constituents of a chemical reaction at a particular temperature. And that's it for today. Come play with the superconductivity demos if you want.
Let's do something with the My roommate, previously break up the other day, and I was looking to get him back. Stick his toothpaste in there for about 10 minutes.
Scott.
Okay, I want
to hold it. YVCO, right there on the screen.
Yeah. Ooh, that's cold.
Where are we going to go?
Oh,
then I can do it.
Tonight or tomorrow?
Tonight.
I'm making myself like
a... Oh, no, that's fine. I was just making sure.
But,
I'm going to love to take my phone.
Where did this call. Come from?
Oh, you think I'm
going to find out if they're working. The website at Oak Ridge National Laboratory.
I'm going to need a lot of this, though.
That's right.
Is that website posted somewhere?
Yeah. So if you go to my research website, look under talks, find my talk called Concepts on High Temperature Superconductivity. About midway through is this website.
How much full is it? Oh, there's a ton left.
There's a lot left. We should do
so something. So basically, it's good shake and bake. They just put the materials together, crush them up together in a crucible, bake them at 900 degrees under an oxygen flow.
What's the pellet press for?
To smush it into a little pellet shape like that.
Do you do that when it's so hot?
No, you just need to crush it up and stick them all together, and then you get it.
What should
you
do?
So it's basically a lot better to buy the kit.
Toss it.
I would just buy the Edmund Scientific kit, yeah.
Did they sell one, like...
A big one?
Yeah.
Oh, dang it, I spilled.
No, you didn't. It's all dry.
Thanks.
Watch your toes.
Yeah.
So I had a question about...
Are you able to eat your yogurt with chopsticks?
Yeah.
You ate the whole thing?
Yeah, it's gone.
This
yeah.
is still being recorded, all right. The important thing.
Let's freeze the thing.
So, the
equation yeah.
for the
law of mass action.
It had a free energy on the top and a temperature on the bottom.
Okay.
So how do you get any kind of temperature difference? This is a free energy like tau log and tau log.
Let's see.
Does the concentration have a temperature difference?
So now we break down the word.
Oh, I didn't.
I've never seen anyone eat yogurt.
I'm sure it's not. I mean, why would you? Unless that's all you
have.
So,
you really
Yeah, 70% of your air is one. Or no, one at low temperature.
Oh. So we have to remember what the quantum temperature looks like.
Because, I mean, go ahead. All right, at high temperature, this would go to zero. One. And then at low temperature, this would go to infinity. So it would act opposite of
one. Right, so then it must go to the quantum concentration. So.
But I mean, wouldn't the exponential dominate? Because it goes to whatever faster the other guy is. Unless the other guy has.
It'll dominate part of it. So V to the minus.
Yes, but actually, the F doesn't have any. The F. Okay, for the internal one, I think it still has a linear.
Yeah, I mean, we'd have to substitute in everything, right? You have an in Q. Depends on how far and something else.
Okay.
Right? So that's to worry about.
So that goes how big at big temperature. So and zero at low temperature.
I might have this upside down. Well, we have NQ in the book. And your F internal. We have to calculate that one.
I had my fun.
Somebody's gonna lose it.
You know, there should be like a physics class where you just come and play with stuff.
It's called the outreach program. But I'm all for that. I think that's what live classes are supposed to be. Live classes are supposed to be you come and play with stuff.
Unlike.
You see, but in my high school art physics class was that.
You just came and played with stuff?
Yeah. So and it didn't.
Oh, okay.
No, see, our lab played with stuff.
That's
her opinion.
No, like, our lab for high school, like, we had to calculate.
Just half an hour a day.
Like, we got, like, little, like, penny thrower stuff, and we had to calculate where it would land, depending on the forces and stuff. Like,
we had to do balloons, and then once we calculated, we had to, like, launch balloons out of our water balloons out of our.
Yes, yeah,
we did that for a grade.
Yeah, so you needed incentive.
We
did that, but we didn't do the calculations.
Yeah, so like, so how they did all these calculations and like they missed like my bar and I just chucked it out ahead of my father.
That's why I don't like the lab series at time. It's a, like, modern lab is so boring because you just sit there and watch data pop up on a computer screen.
My high school class,
unless
it's this lab, there's no data. Yeah, I spent 2 months building a huge roller coaster out of these things that were kind of like erector sets.
Yeah.
And it was fun, right? From here to the wall.
Yeah.
And like this tall, it was like this big roller coaster.
Oh, right.
And everything was awesome.
Great.
I spent like 2 months in.
So we had to build
an AV class.
We had to build a motor in high school.
Yeah.
And you weren't given any constraints.
You
could even be that expensive.
Yeah, like, I mean,
so yeah, you know, you had to build your own little spoon. One of those was used aluminum foil at the contact, and you did something that was going to be metal brushes and stuff like that.
Yeah. We just used like the copper wire that has the insulation on it. Just scraped off half of it with the sandpaper.
No, you can
have that way you only get half.
Because see, my friends
are commentating.
Nice.
Yeah, I talk high school.
And then we need something as we are.
Really?
Yeah, it's just a
concentration of
travel. Cool.
That's right.
Cool. My husband teaches at Harrison.
For example,
he's a chemist and teaches physics and chemistry there. I go to his conference and talk to him.
I actually was there with Mr. Smiley.
Like
okay. All right.
A chip or something, right?
Mr. Smiley graduated from here.
What did the device would do with it?
Mr. Smiley.
Mr. Smiley, he's a teacher of Harrison.
His real name is Mr. Smiley.
I was really, really afraid at first because I'm like, remember the name was Mr. Smiley, you would hope he'd be nice. Either that or he's a really big jerk.
I've never met anybody who's heard of this. I don't even know if we were calculated the free energy, the internal free energy.
Yeah, I don't get it.
But you can do it, you know how you do it, right? You calculate the internal degrees of freedom, right? So the internal.
No, there's no problem.
The internal energy is divided by tau. So you write it that way.
I'm real slow.
It's E to the minus free energy internal divided by tau. So so that, and this is actually the term you need for the resolution of the internal anyway. So you don't even really need this stuff, right? You just do this sum. That sum. Depending on.
But that's not.
But why don't we take the easy case? Let's say that, that there are no internal, we can create a. Okay. Okay, so the internal is 1. Okay, so then, what does your thing do?
What's the ultimate goal here?
Mm-hmm.
They're
going to
create a.
Right, where the internal free energy is 0. So now K is proportional to N2 directly. So now we just need to look up NQ.
Yeah, I was trying to find it. I couldn't find the one.
Okay.
Basically, we get some medicine, this medicine is so strong, they affect the other heresy part to the. So it's not body. Like, that's why people get the tidal effect. This is not good, right?
Concentration.
All right. Do you remember, like, about?
This should be the reasonable way to find, you know, the dependency you're talking about. Assume the right internal freedom.
Okay.
And then check to make sure that the quantum concentration is the right.
They have a 1 over tau.
Well, yeah, it's going to be. Yeah, and you don't just need one quantum concentration, right? You need the quantum concentration for 2 times the quantum concentration for
A. A magnetic field in there, then
A squared minus square. That's what you really need.
Put
that all together.
Well, it wouldn't be.
So he said this is a first step to like control that this small device inside of our body.
Yeah, it was pretty early in the class.
This is all about learning.
Oh, heck, we probably had it on the board. Let's see.
Device even.
Your book is right here, you know.
Oh, okay.
Quantum concentration is m tau, which is pi h bar squared.
I was talking the other day
about
the CD.
Okay, so this guy will go like then. See, the it'll have mass dependencies. This is some constant minus tau to minus 3/2.
Where did my lecture notes go from today?
No, I have them in my hand.
Oh, those are my lecture notes.
Okay,
I'm like, where are they all?
I stole them. All
right.
Rotational modes will look like in quantum mechanics, That would be an L squared.
Let's see how far you can bring another.
Sleep and not speak is what I'm about.
Okay.
P squared over two N over L, like P cross R. So I need a length in here somewhere.
No.
I don't remember what our other classes you put here, but it's going to go like L squared if the expectation value is comprehended here, L times L is one. Okay, so that's what you put in here.
Plus other degrees. And, well, like, could you only have rotational?
Well, and, yeah, I mean, pretty much it moves up to your limit, you set your rotational, and then at higher temperature, you start setting your vibration. Yeah. It's actually equal to this pretty
rotational and vibrational.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's what your sum over freedom means is sum over L.
So then you'd have a 1 over N and
the guy
is dead. So then you take a log z times tau, so tau log z over tau.
But you don't really need that because you just need z internal directly.
Oh,
z internal was what was directly in your.
Okay, here's a question. Just
maybe I'm part of it, yeah.
Listen to this.
Well, I had s internal.
You have
even the minus mu j f internal over tau, that's all that is z.
Oh,
that's the internal.
Okay, right.
So I really need
to,
yeah, here we go.
There's two magnets.
And z internal.
And then
so
the
you
other
just
have
to
be
internal.
Okay.
And
it's kind of like crazy.
Yeah, you have two magnets that are exactly the same.
Not really.
I
think it's
on the
infinite
side.
All
times
double is one.
So the
card. It's just
going to
count.
Oh,
that's
probably.
Quite
serious.
Yeah, I'd have to look up that
stuff.
It might have a closed form. It might not have a closed form.
There was a.
Think about it.
Oh, yeah.
I want to give you an answer.
But anyway, this is how you do it.
All right. And you need to have an option to make.
Yep. And other stuff.
Yeah, and earth metals. Okay. No, wait. No. Why did you do that? Like, why? Like, is there a relation between the two? Well, as far as we know, the important part is the top rocks have been playing with the stuff. There's stuff in between. And the stuff in between was so these guys go like this. Proper oxygen is basically a square lattice where there are coppers on the corners and oxygen's corner. Oh, I'm using chalk when we have a whiteboard here. I won't get chalk on my whiteboard markers. We'll just go with this. So you look like this. Oxygen's coppers. And the coppers have a net spin associated with them. And the oxygens are kind of out of the picture. So they tend to be anti-aligned like this. So this is opposite, opposite, opposite. Mm-hmm. And then the other layer, what the other layer does is this had been an anti-ferromagnet, and the other layer you substitute out barium for yttrium, for example. And you'll end up pulling out a spin and leaving a hole behind. So whatever metal you choose has to have, like, if this spin was that way, it has to have a spin that way for that one, and then the spin like that, that one.
Well, yeah, it is true that the spins tend to anti-align in this material.
Does it do it for every one
yep.
that abuts?
Yep.
So you'd have spin, 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 then you'd have hole, hole.
Yeah, actually what we think happens is, if I can just abstract this, we think the spins, when you start adding holes, tend to do this.
So then they cancel out here.
Right.
But it, like, it's a double hole.
Well, it's a whole line of holes. That's the stripes that I was talking about.
So then
the
this
little
is
one
a
straight one. One-dimensional lines of holes. A
yeah.
holes can act like
and
that.
And then this is a line of holes.
That's, well, it's a line
but
of spins.
But there's like
Yeah, hole, but this isn't a hole, this is a spin.
Yeah.
And this is where I'm missing a spin, so we call it a hole.
Yeah.
And this actually has, isn't just one hole per side, it's actually some concentration of holes.
Yeah.
So this is actually a liquid, like, bit in here.
A liquid line of hole.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, I mean, is it, like, is it significant that if you look at it one-dimensionally this way, there's a net zero spin, but if you look at it this way, wires, there's
no net spin.
Yeah, there's
no.
Yeah. But if you look at it, like, I guess there's no way you could look at it.
Yeah, there's no net spin.
I mean, unless you look at just the, like, one guy.
Yeah. So these guys are a bit weird because superconductors don't like magnetic fields,
mm-hmm.
but there's static microscopic magnetism in here coexisting with superconductivity. It's odd.
Mm.
So that's part of the weirdness. We could do that. But yeah, there's no net magnetic moment.
But there's tiny little...
That's right. There's little static moments all over the place, but they sum up to zero. They're still important. I mean, ferromagnets. So regular magnets are ferromagnets.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll have all their moments aligned the same way.
Yeah. So that they add the big...
That's right. And they have certain properties, like being refrigerator magnets. And there's something called an antiferromagnet. And they line up opposite.
So this is like an antiferromagnet.
This is like an antiferromagnet.
Oh, wait,
it's shifted a little bit away from it. Yeah. We actually call it a whole dope antiferromagnet.
Doped? Yeah, like, okay, like you can dope silicon with
right.
Positive hole.
Right. So you dope this with holes.
And
do you have a moment to give me hand carry this stuff back?
Yeah. And okay. So the copper and the oxygen maybe can naturally create a doped system?
Not the copper and oxygen, but you use the materials, you use the
well, I mean, maybe
atoms in between.
Yeah. So, I mean, not by themselves, but that's what kind of helps to dope the metal.
No, you're actually doping the copper oxygen plane using the yttrium and the barium, which
okay.
is not sitting in the plane, it's sitting in the next plane.
So it's the oxygen. So the copper and oxygen get doped to cold because of the metal. Okay. Kind of like. Usually they dope silicon with, gosh, what was it? I think that it was like it was silicon oxide, I know.
That's just glass.
Oh.
Or sand. I know, they always say silicon oxide. It's, I think it's a little glass layer. So silicon is a semiconductor, and then silicon oxide is the insulator, but it's just just window glass.
Okay. Because for a while I worked on silicon detector.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
In the higher energy group.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. So silicon dioxide. Is glass or sand.
Well, I think they joked the silicon with the oxygen because it helped it to like maintain. Like, I don't know, like. Like to keep out. I think it helped with keeping out impurities before they like doped it. And that's why they use silicon oxide.
Okay.
It's been a while. Like,
silicon oxide is an insulator.
Okay.
Actually,
well, what they wanted to do was like have a good current flow without disruption.
Yeah.
Like detect the flow of current in the like a little charge.